digital democracy is just an extension of democracy in a broader sense. So it really depends how informed, aware of citizens are. What is the political culture? What are the other channels of policy making in the country? So indeed, if people are underinformed and unskilled and can be easily manipulated, they can fall for the populism.
Welcome to the Digital Government Podcast. Tune in to discover the future of governance and ways of getting there.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Digital Government Podcast with your usual host, Federico Plantera. I'm a journalist, a sociologist, and researcher, today accompanied by a fellow sociologist, I might say, who is Dmytro Chutki, expert at the Governance Academy, now part of the Governance and Engagement Competence Center. And Dmytro, I'm very glad to have you here joining the podcast today.
My pleasure.
So a little bit of an introduction, because you are also, let's say, a new addition in among the ranks of e-Governance Academy. And you are coming mostly from, let's say, research in academia, but not only, because your background is also in consulting. And your focus has been so far civic engagement and participation using the digital tools. You will obviously correct me if I am, you know, missing anything, but together with being an expert at the Governance Academy, you're also working as a research fellow in digital governance at the Johann Skytte Institute of Political Studies at the University of Tartu. And you're featured today also because, in any case, in your work, you have as well advised governments, and particularly, for example, in Ukraine, on reforms to with regard to access to information, public accountability, and civic participation as well. So, Dmytro, I would like to do with you some sort of a helicopter view a little bit, because the topic of digital engagement and participation is something that we addressed and keep addressing a lot at eGovernance Academy, not only through workshops and conferences, but also in previous episodes of the podcast. However, what I would like to do with you today is indeed this sort of like briefing on what changed recently in this field. What do I mean with this is that we often refer to, for example, especially in academia, no, in terms of like seminal works, to articles or studies that have been carried out in, for example, Brazil or other countries like that, for the inception, let's say, of civic participation in digital governance. These works date back to maybe even like 20, if not even 30 years ago. But what happened most recently instead? So how, for example, what are actually the latest trends in digital engagement and participation, at least from your point of view and what you have observed in the past 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, so first of all, many things remain the same. So the question is, you know, how big is the change? But if it is here, we may notice that people are shifting from classic web-based platforms to social media for participation. So, you know, governments used to create all these tools and projects and civic initiatives. Everyone wants a dedicated platform. And this sometimes diverts attention. And then you have to register for every platform once in a while. So that kind of makes an extra effort. But people use social media on an everyday basis. So sometimes they just reach politicians directly. And this creates like a buzz, you know, about some points, and then a politician takes them into account. So you see, it's a kind of informal, like agenda setting, e-participation way that is going in parallel. It's not formalized, it's not standardized, but it's here. A more recent one is the, of course, artificial intelligence. It's just starting to boom. Although I came across several cases when it was used by municipal authorities, for example, so they would analyze popular sentiments using artificial intelligence tools to see the trends, to kind of structure them, cluster, and get some themes like what bothers citizens, what do they want to know. So these are the two big things that I think are the trends.
Yeah, because I think that the topic and in general of digital engagement and participation, you know, has gone through quite an evolution, let's say, in the past 20, 30 years, in the sense that, as you said, for example, in the very beginning, it was governments, let's say, together with, for example, CSOs, civil society organizations, to set up, let's say, together in sort of like some sort of a, I don't know, agreement between the parties, let's say, these platforms. Then maybe like 20 years ago, with the rise also of the new social movements, you know, there were like more groups that were that sort of like wanted to take more space, you know, like that was not given previously to them. Today, what is the, how to say, what's the pulse, let's say, of participation from the side of citizens in policy making, in deciding, for example, also how cities should look like and something like that? How, like, to what extent and to what degree citizens are engaging, let's say, with government and policies today in general, in your opinion?
No, that was a good clarification, because it really depends where. the country context and the regional context, they define a lot, and you can find substantial variation within European Union itself. But I know for sure that one of the best formats that people do influence local policy making in these settlements and communities is participatory budgeting, because it designed the way that people deliberate among themselves, that their voice is mandatory for authorities to implement. They vote for the projects, they become project leaders, sometimes they even co-implement them. So it's really empowering tool, because it's like the whole policy-making process that they engaged in, from the generating ideas up to controlling and monitoring, overseeing the results. And Europe has hundreds of thousands of municipalities that are there, that have this tool. It probably came to the plateau, so it was booming, I don't know, some years ago. Now there is like saturation phase. But it's good, because it became part of normal policymaking and people are getting used to it. And new generations of young citizens are growing with the idea that it's okay, that it's regular, normal thing to influence the urban environment and everything. So that's one, that's major thing. And newer thing is the format which is called citizen assemblies. But it's mostly on a national or EU scale. So it proved to be efficient. I mean, lots of ideas were gathered and politicians seemed to like it. So now it will be multiplied and promoted more. So we should expect a boom on this format as well.
And I guess as well, we talked about, I mean, we briefly mentioned the topic of tools, no? In the sense, for example, from web-based platforms, more or less institutional or formalized, let's say, to, for example, social media. Do you think that this sort of change is happening toward, like, together with a shift in demographics based on which generations use which tools for, or like prefer which tools? Because, for example, I could imagine that the generations more of millennials or of like baby boomers would prefer, for example, certain channels of communication with the government, even for participation, while instead the Gen Z, for example, might prefer more other channels in that sense. What has been happening with that respect? Meaning, have governments somehow, or public administrations somehow, adapted, let's say, their communication and participation channels to these demographic shifts as well, because they are both demographic and cultural, no? Or where there is maybe like some loopholes where governments should look into in order to enhance, let's say, this inclusive participation and not just make, you know, reference only to certain demographic groups instead of others?
So it really depends on the country. depends on the country, because like in Estonia you would see that like Facebook is a predominant social media that like beats the other channels like 5 times. So it's still like the dominant one, although like in other Western European countries it's more like Twitter or X, which is now. But I assume that in some countries, well, outside the European Union, I know for sure it's happened in Ukraine, and it might be a generational issue that these kind of text-based social media like Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter are getting replaced by video-based social media like YouTube and TikTok. So Instagram is something between, because it's like more visual and video. And YouTube and TikTok, they're really kind of rising stars in this sense. So then the participation should be somehow integrated there, like upvoting with like or dislikes. But I haven't seen like tools like that for normal policymaking. So politicians seem to stuck to these traditional channels. And maybe they're kind of missing these younger audiences. So this is something to work on.
Yeah, because I think that with the something that I've noticed also with my Ukrainian friends, let's say in the past couple of years of war in Ukraine, of Russia's aggression in Ukraine, is, for example, the rise also of the extreme rise of Telegram in that sense as well, no, as a tool for communication. But that's maybe more one directional, no, like more from a speaker, let's say, and a broadcaster towards the public rather than maybe the other way around as well, no.
That's a good observation. So I would say these are messengers or channels, which are indeed like another types of media, because they allow news to be delivered to bigger audiences. So I would say that Telegram is a regional thing. So it's widespread in Ukraine, Belarus, Russia, maybe the Baltic states, but not much in Central or Western Europe. Messenger chats, which are Facebook Messenger chats, which are being promoted now, maybe they will become these news channels. Who knows? But I haven't seen the trend becoming like apparent yet. The risk with the Telegram that there is unclarity, like who is it controlling, what are the ties with the Russian government. So some media experts say it's riskier to use it because of the security and surveillance and things like that. Of course, its owners reject all these things. They say, no, we're independent, but it's something to keep in mind. There are more kind of niche things like Mastodon and others, I would say elite social media, super protected, or Signal, but it's for personal communication. And they try to engage citizens, but it will be always a more elite niche group thing. So this is a vibrant and developing area, and we should monitor closely how it develops, because things may change quickly in a year or less.
Yeah, I think it's important, speaking of tools, when it comes to participation and engagement, not just for what concerns, for example, the tools that governments and public administrations can develop and make available, but also the tools that the people themselves, like where they are, what they use. For example, I don't know, I could recall a little bit the moment, since we spoke about also the new social movements. Obviously, as a journalist, I remember now the moment when there was that rise in citizen journalism, so-called, no? Where, for example, the communication, let's say, the participation in the creation of media was not anymore unidirectional, let's say, so only like from newspapers towards the people, but it was also the people providing newspapers or the media landscape in general, the information space, with content and information that they created themselves, so that in some way they were also in a lot of ways they were participating in the creation of media and content in that sense. But speaking of tools, and also you referring to a word that you mentioned, which is that participation and digital engagement had, you know, a moment of boom, let's say, in terms of support and also spread. I think that maybe we're talking about some 10 years ago, no? Because I remember that around 2010, 2012, there was like a lot of buzz around participation tools. But if you were to look exactly at those, at these 10 years, these past 10 years, where do you see, in what countries or at what levels do you see that digital engagement has been blooming particularly, let's say? Maybe you can also refer a little bit to your experience in Ukraine, because I guess that the process in increasing, let's say, transparency and accountability has taken place relatively recently, no?
It depends what I define as recently. So the thing is that indeed, like internationally, e-participation started like in early 2010s. That's correct, because the governments introduced these digital solutions for governance, and then the new avenues for policy input from the public, they boomed indeed. But then there's a question of like political setting, political constellation and will. In some countries it started earlier, in others later. For example, I was studying Latvia, and they introduced e-petitions because they had a political crisis of trust to the government and corruption scandals. And e-petitions were seen as a compromise, as a something that people can have their voice heard and politicians would listen to them. And it worked. And it looks like in many countries, these tools, they come up as a solution, as a salvation during crisis. So there are like, you know, waves of e-participation. I have a whole paper about that. And in Ukraine, it started after the Revolution of Dignity in 2014. So basically like 9 years ago, because new government went in power, new president, and the politicians were kind of... newcomers. They didn't know what to expect. There was a window of opportunity that the politicians were open to new ways, and citizens provided the input. So we had like e-petitions introduced for the first time, participatory budgeting, and other experiments. Even some voting for policies, not for electing politicians, and in Estonia, of course. But we did that. Estonia, of course, did it much earlier in 2003. So basically 20 years ago, they had internet voting. But it's very kind of standard thing that you elect politicians. Later, they had even citizen assemblies with crowdsourcing. So Estonia experimented a lot with many things and has a good kind of story of evolving these things and coming to a more... Now they have not only like suggesting things or voting, but deliberating and kind of getting community of activists around it. And that's what I see as an efficient thing. When you combine several ways of providing input to public policy or politics, then it works well, because people can enter from different ways and either talk or vote or click and in journalistic way, if it's kind of highlighted properly in the media, that it's on agenda. So you need many, many things to be in place to have that efficient. But really, crisis, revolutions, elections, or even like ecological crisis, heat waves, they all bring this upfront.
But how much do you think that the let's say the availability and also the degree, the intensity, let's say, of participation and civic participation goes together or like hand in hand with digital development? Meaning, should a country in order to see an increased participation through digital tools also necessarily already be at a very high level of digital maturity, or let's say that this is something that is not necessarily paired with it, let's say that is not necessarily dependent from it?
So, you know, it depends on the purpose. So let's say for public discussion, the requirements are quite minimal. You know, when we had Arab Spring and Twitter revolutions, people just had smartphones with access to social media and it worked well. So they self-organized online for offline activities. They also said, did what you said, this kind of popular journalism, so bloggers and live streaming and things like that. So, I mean, smartphone is enough and it's pretty widespread, even in poorer countries. And even if the government's digital development is lower, people can still communicate online because these things are easier to install. Basically, you need a network operator, whatever. And well, of course, you need
a fit device for that, a device that is fit essentially, no?
But also free space, because, for example, in Belarus, in order to access internet, you need to register your SIM card and then with a passport. And this means that you're controlled. I mean, you are identified as a person. Well, in other countries, you can use internet like anonymously and you can be free in what you speak. So this is for deliberation, for decision making, which is more, let's say, high stake. Endeavor, you do need some requirements in terms of cybersecurity, identification of a person, proper discussion to sort out bots and botnets and other foreign interferences. So to have e-voting in terms of elections online, you do need a certain level of government development. So in Ukraine, we still have this discussion. Should we have elections of public officials online or not, because this is a risky thing, especially in the context of war with Russia. So, yeah, this is something to work on. And Estonia actually is a good example that they made this solid infrastructural basis, trust to the government, services are secure. And having this base, you can exploit this foundation and develop more more participation based on this. It's more secure, it's more trustworthy.
Dmytro, before I have a few more questions for you, but sure. Before heading to those, I wanted maybe to provide another example that you made me think of when you spoke about the more than the relationship between participation and the tools available, rather of the relationship between participation and the state of health, let's say, of democracy in that moment in a country. Because, for example, you were mentioning the Arab Springs, no? And the Arab Springs, the years where they started in 2011, if I'm not wrong. And in any case, around those years, they developed in, you know, as we know, Tunisia, Syria, Egypt, and like all the North African countries and part of the Middle East. But as well, at the same time, I remember what was happening in the Italian political landscape, because in 2011, in Italy, especially in November, there was the one of the toughest moments, politically speaking, of the sovereign debt crisis, where, for example, the government that at the time was led by Berlusconi essentially was in such a crisis that Berlusconi had to resign. What I remember is that at the very first elections, like national elections that we had, the party that gained most of the votes in absolute terms compared to all the others was the Five Stars Movement. Five Stars Movement, which was an active proponent first at the local level and then also at the national level. They never got to actually do that, but at least also within their internal practices of civic participation and political participation through digital engagement, in the sense they had set up a platform for members to vote on certain things. It was called Russo, if I'm not wrong. And so that was a moment of economic and political crisis. And it was a moment of economic and political crisis in Western/Mediterranean Europe, where, in any case, there was, you know, again, this this rise in popularity, let's say, of instances and requests for more space for participation, you know, in a way, because I think that that could be taken as a proxy of that. But instead, one of the other two things that I wanted to ask you was, first of all, we spoke about some practices in digital engagement. What are some of the best practices that you instead have, you know, researched and particularly focused on and that you would like to bring up as, you know, particularly good examples? We already spoke about some of them, but let's do this, you know, as a little bit of a crunch, let's say, of those and of those that maybe we have not mentioned yet.
May I comment on your reflections about the health of democracy before that?
Of course you can.
Sure. Just to set this background. So indeed, many studies show that digital democracy is just an extension of democracy in a broader sense. So it really depends how informed, aware of citizens are. What is the political culture? What are the other channels of policymaking in the country? So indeed, if people are underinformed and unskilled and can be easily manipulated, they can fall for the populism, the case that you talked about, for example, and in many other countries. And it doesn't matter much whether the citizens are reached by digital or traditional means, or by analog media, whatever, or by meetings. The result is what's matter, and the procedure. If the procedure is flawed, if the messages are manipulated, then that's the problem. So digital domain just provides more intricate ways of doing that. For example, micro-targeting, which when people's profiles would be analyzed using tools for social media, but others as well. And they would be delivered different messages. And the problem is that people won't see that the messages aren't inconsistent. So populists would tell one group the things that they would like to hear, and the other groups that they would like to hear. And this might be even contradictory messages. In traditional media, you would see that because there is only one channel. But in micro-targeting advertising, this can be done different ways. So we already know and heard of this Cambridge Analytica thing. There are attempts to regulate this and limit and control, but still the risk are there. And especially if there are botnets are hired to kind of create an impression or illusion of some agenda, this can, harm democracy. So we do need to have this discussion and raise awareness. People know that these are the risks and these are healthy ways to have this cyber communication, digital hygiene. But again, of course, this is extra. So this is like, civic awareness on a digital, on an extra level. So it gets more more complicated to make an informed, smart, and logical citizens, with the rationale. So how it can work well, getting back to the question. I think one of the best examples is the Irish Citizen Assembly. So they had a couple of those, and the idea behind it that they combine multiple democratic formats to discuss a policy, to reach a consensus, and to make it legal and legitimate. So they had this challenge that they wanted to reform a constitution, and while getting there, they also found that there are debatable issues. They were not actually raised in the society much. So they had same-sex marriage and the right for abortion. And there was an impression that in a Catholic country, people would go against those. Well, when they brought this to light, it turned out that people actually were not against it. It was just, a spiral of silence that if you don't talk about it, you don't know. But turned out there is like enough liberal people in the society that the majority said, yes, it's fine. And these are citizen rights, these are individual freedoms, and we should open up this for the people. But they went a very elaborate way to get to this and other policies. So they launched online crowdsourcing of ideas. People could suggest anything to reform the constitution. And then they would kind of cluster things. What are the major topics that bother people? Then they randomly selected 100 persons. And they would represent society. So this is, as you know, sociological, statistical tool that works for surveys well. So if you do it properly, then this small sample However small it is, like in this case 100, of course we'd better have like 400 or more, but still with some error of probability they do represent society, because they were not the most active or the poorest or the middle class. They come from different walks of life, and they are a society in a miniature. This is when people of different professions and genders and views can meet and talk. So they deliberated in several rounds. And they were presented ideas, but experts from different, let's say, directions. So again, like, had an expert input on that. And politicians also were part of the discussion. So people met with politicians and were able to kind of deliver their thoughts to them. Then they presented a policy text that was delivered to the parliament. Then there was a referendum. So there was a discussion in the media also, and public knew what was happening. This was broadcast. And then public voted, and then the parliament, you know, approved these decisions. So on multiple levels, deliberation, expert input, crowdsourcing of ideas, direct policy voting, and representative democracy of politicians, this was confirmed. So there's a consensus. This is like an ideal. It's costly, yeah, but then it then you have a proper discussion. And when you change the constitution, this is the price that you can pay for.
I love that this mechanism reminds me a little bit of, for example, how the jury used to function in Athens.
Absolutely.
You know, a little bit. The people were randomly selected, and like there were many. They were always, you know, a number. For example, like 1,001. People, mm-hmm. so that you will never get, you know, parity in the judgment. But I like that this is a mechanism that, you know, hasn't come too far off from what we already sort of like thought of in terms of like democratic processes already, like well, definitely a couple thousand years ago. But Dimitro, one last question, exactly to wrap up this episode, telegraphically, like in a few words, but even more than a few, actually, what would be, on the basis of exactly your research and also what we spoke of today, what would be, let's say, some of the main suggestions or recommendations for governments in order to exactly enhance and increase and improve, because we're also talking about the quality of it, let's say, citizen engagement and the dialogue, essentially, with them?
Right. Not an easy thing in practice, because in theory, it might look, you know, very crystal clear. But I mean, from my experience in being engaged in civil society, I can also confirm that what really works is genuine transparency from authority sides, willingness to open up, to cooperate. And this is like step-by-step things, you know, when there is a suggestion, when the civil society accepts this invitation, then there is a dialogue, then you build trust step-by-step, because trust is not given, it's not just something that you take for granted. You have to kind of prove, earn, and it's easier to lose it, you know. So this is about relationships. Ideally, when there is a collaboration on a joint project, for example, people have a common goal, maybe reform something or have an economic breakthrough or introduce new freedoms or to fight an aggressor or to like bring the union together and make it stronger, then there is something that unites people. And then everyone has his or her role in this process. So this is great, having a common goal, openness, transparency, and dialogue. And when you see the results, then they reinforce themselves. Also, there should be an opportunity for everyone to participate. So when people feel that they can have an effect on what's going on in their country, they feel proud, they feel encouraged, they feel empowered, and they are more eager to support the policies and give government like extra credit of trust. So if there is like a positive circle, then it will reinforce itself. So it really takes a lot from the government side, from the civil society, from the active public to do this together.
Dimitro, thanks a lot for joining us today for this episode.
Thank you.
And thanks a lot also to all our audience for tuning in again. I would say that that's it from both of us, so including from your host, and I hope to see you all at the next episode of the Digital Government Podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by the eGovernance Academy. Tune in next time.